is ready for some football. We'll talk about the appeal and the legality and the cost of a popular football pastime during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Plus, with college campuses gearing up for another school year, financial planner Kevin McKinley will have a 5-point financial checklist for college students and their parents. You will want to take notes because this will be on the test. And you will want to call in with your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us from our WPR studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
You know, UW-Madison is really busy right now. Parents are moving their kids into the dorms. Cars are driving the wrong way on one-way streets. Hordes of students are wandering around. Is it the same thing in Eau Claire?
In a lot of these college towns in Wisconsin and across the country, I think this is probably more stress is inflicted upon the community and its residents over this week than it is the rest of the year combined.
That's right. And we will talk about your financial checklist for college students and their parents a little later in the program. But first, besides being an exciting time for college kids and their parents, it's an exciting time of year for a certain kind of sports fan. And you don't mean Badger fans or Blue Gold fans. Who do you mean, Kevin?
No, I mean fantasy football players, and these are people who become their own general managers of a fantasy football team. Typically, right now is when leagues are having their drafts or some have an auction. The origin is actually there was a baseball rotisserie league that started this, but the first fantasy football league, according to Bloomberg News, was the Greater Oakland Professional Pigskin Prognosticators League, that was formed in 1963, and it has now grown to the point where about 1 out of 10 Americans participate in a some kind of fantasy league. About 3/4 of those are in a football league, and it's very popular in the Midwest. Yahoo, which sponsors a very large league with millions of players, has did a search over 7 days where they wanted to see who was searching for the term in mid-August. Fantasy football. And they found that the highest portion per capita were almost all Midwestern communities. Fargo was number one, but Green Bay was number 8, and Madison was number 10.
Well, I believe it. My nephew in Madison is on a football league, a fantasy football league, and I just don't get it. He was on Facebook recruiting people. how does this work?
Well, sometimes some of the big organizations, the online organizations like ESPN or Yahoo, have large leagues where that you're anonymously competing against other teams. But usually it's leagues of friends and coworkers where they pool an entry fee if there's a draft, or if there's an auction, they bid on players as they come up, and then there's a cap on how much they can spend on their entire team. And then they pick skill positions plus a defense. So they pick quarterbacks, wide receivers, tight ends, and running backs. And then each week they go against another team in the league and start those various players against each other, and then accumulate points for the player's actual actions on the field. Like if that player scores a touchdown, the fantasy league might get 6 points. If the defense gets an interception, that team might get 3 points for the fantasy team. And then at the end of the season, the team with the best record usually gets a portion of the entry fees after the costs are covered.
Ah, is that legal?
It depends. State law governs if this is legal or not, but because there appears to be some skill involved in terms of actually picking the players and deciding whom to start and whom to draft and when to use a particular one on the waiver wire or whatever, it probably falls within a definition of skill versus luck, and therefore it can be legal. And even if it weren't, it's unlikely that, you know, people are going to bust up your coffee room and rip down the board with the league's winners on top of it. What's actually more likely is that if you're going to end up in court over fantasy football, it's going to be because some dispute over a player who seemed to violate league rules in trying to build a better team.
Well, all in all, just seems like good, clean fun, is it?
You would think, and the definition of being old is when the time you use the word fantasy most is when it revolves around a football team rather than other pursuits. But it changes the way fans watch games. I've seen diehard Packer fans rooting for Jay Cutler, the Bears quarterback, to throw a touchdown against the Packers because it would help their own fantasy team better. And then there is, of course, the time spent on it. The Fantasy Trade Sports Association says that the average player spends about 3 hours per week going over his or her team. It's a four-month season usually, so that works out to about 1 week out of your life spent on your fantasy football team each year. The cost isn't usually very much. It's maybe about probably $50 or so typically to get into a league. Some of them go up as high as a $10,000 entry fee. But more so about the lost productivity while you worry about your team and spend time on Facebook recruiting other teams. And also keep in mind that your employer may not appreciate you using workplace computers to assemble your team and have a clever dialogue back and forth with your opponents.
Right. And you know what else is annoying is if you are watching a game with fantasy football people, they're on their phones and they're looking at what their other teams are doing. And yes, they're like, you know, cheering at bad things that happen to your team. So it would be wise not to do that too. Do you play fantasy football, Kevin?
I do not. Much in the way that I have never partaken in certain recreational drugs. I know that once I start, I'll never stop, so I better not start.
Yeah, it sure seems like it's a sort of an obsession. And my last question is, what is a blue gold?
We're still working on that. It's been about 85 years, I think, in Eau Claire that the blue gold mascot has been around. About every 5 years, a vote comes up for it, and usually some strange-looking bird or dinosaur or something emerges, and then they forget about it, and then 5 years later, the vote comes up again. So I'll get back to you as soon as we get a definitive answer.
Go Blue Golds. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. And that being said, if you have a question for Kevin about a personal finance matter, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag, and a listener named Linda says, are there still home loans for first-time homeowners that do not require a 20% down payment? So, Kevin, are there loans available like that?
Yes, there was a big program a few years ago to try to boost the housing market up to let people get into a house with much less than the standard 20% down payment. And there still are a couple, and it depends on the state and local region, but the Down Payment Plus program in Wisconsin and Illinois allows people who have 80% or lower of the median income in a particular area. It will help them with the lesser of $8,000 or 25% of the mortgage with their down payment. And it's at FHLBC, that's the Federal Home Loan Bank. It was a long link to the actual guide for it, so we'll put it up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Okay, so does Linda have any other options?
There's some formal programs, like the VA still has something that allows people to do it, and you can get an FHA mortgage on certain properties or so, but it depends on the situation, and people should actually not preclude themselves from buying a home just because they may not have 20% down, or they don't think their credit's good enough, or their income's too low, or whatever. Talk to the lenders. They know about all of these programs, and LendingTree said that earlier this year, the average down payment for mortgages in various states, in Wisconsin anyway, was 13.7% of the purchase price, and there were nine other states that had even lower amounts for it. So it's a good rule of thumb to have 20% down, but just because you may not have that, don't bar yourself. Let the lender tell you whether or not you qualify, and keep in mind that the lenders do not get paid unless the loan gets made.
Okay, so what other suggestions might you have for those like Linda who want to buy their first home?
Start by going checking your credit score at myfico.com. You can pay a little fee for it. And if you want to get an advertising-supported one, go to creditkarma.com. That's Credit Karma with a K. Verify the accuracy of the information on your credit report by getting a free report at annualcreditreport.com, annualcreditreport.com, and you can get one report per bureau. There are three large bureaus per year free. So you just want to check and make sure that all the information on there is correct, because when you have to go back and correct it, it can take a long time to do that, and sometimes the lender will knock you off because there's a ding on there, and it's bad enough when that happens. It's worse when it's not actually true.
All right, so then once the credit situation is in order?
Again, expect to come in with 20% down, but that's not an absolute standard. Instead, make sure that you have paid all of your bills on time, even if it's just a minimum payment, and don't pay debt down. A lot of people feel like they have to get all their debt paid off before they can go in and apply for a mortgage, and that's not necessarily true. And even if it is, the lender will say, well, we'd like you to pay this amount off, or can you come up with $3,000 to pay this credit card off so that we can get your debt-to-income ratio closer to the 45% of gross monthly income. They want your debt, your total debt payments to be under 45% of your gross monthly income, and your mortgage payment, property taxes, insurance, etc., should be less than 28% of your gross monthly income. And if you do get the mortgage, get it put down as little as you possibly can, and then get it for 30 years on a fixed rate and pay it off as slowly as you possibly can as well.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. Coming up a little bit later, On Your Money, why retirees should err on the side of caution. Plus, Kevin will have that that checkpoint list for college students and their parents, a financial checklist for college students and their parents. And we have now open lines for you if you have personal finance questions for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Money, money.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And let's hit the phones. Matt in Madison is with us first. Hello, Matt. Oops, I got to push the right button for you, Matt. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Matt.
Yeah, hey, boss. I got a small business, and I got a 9-month-old and a 2.5-year-old. And they're both going to be going to college. I'm not sure what is the best vehicle for me to invest for their education. What do you think?
Best vehicle? Normally,
what do you think is the best way to manage the money?
Sure. Are you saving money for your own retirement, Matt?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Are you using like a SEP plan or SIMPLE or one of those acronyms?
Yeah. Basically, yes. I transferred my IRA over. I guess the advisor I'm using is not a big fan of the IRA. I've been putting away a bit into life insurance, and I've also just having a pool of liquid money. That we have, and that's getting about a 5% return and some utilities.
Okay. There are a couple different ways I would go. If you're eligible for it, I would prefer that you start with a Roth IRA for three reasons. The first one being is that the Roth IRA is money you can use in retirement, and because you can borrow money to go to college, but you can't borrow money to retire, that should be your first priority. Second thing being is that if you do need it for college, you can pull the contributions you've made to the Roth IRA out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And even the most successful business person runs into a cash crunch once in a while, and I'd like you to have access to some of your savings so that you can get at it to cover you and smooth the hard times over. And if finally none of your retirement's covered, and then the business doesn't ever need the cash for it, you can always pull that money back out of the Roth IRA and use it to pay for your kids' college. And you don't have to necessarily do it while they're in college. You can do it after they're done and have them pay off loans. And just as a word of advice for you, don't plan on paying for all the college expenses, and don't pay for the first year or two of expenses. Make the kids borrow money for the first year or two, and then if they stay in school and they do a good job and you still can afford it, then pay for the last year or two. And then once you retire and reach your goals, Matt, then you can always help them pay the loans off that they've taken out. But if they've taken loans out, they've got, you know, 40 years of work history to repay those loans. You have a much shorter time to fund your own retirement and a very short time to cover any needed business expenses. So probably want to make this the third priority. And again, don't expect to have $100,000 on the day they turn 18.
No, fair enough. Are you a family man, Kevin?
You mean, do I have one?
Yes,
yeah,
he does.
Family, yeah.
Yeah, as far as I know, I haven't seen him in a while, but I know my checks are going someplace. So yes, I am married and, with three children, and we make them watch a lot of TV because we're trying to dumb them down so they can just barely get into the cheapest school we can possibly afford.
Oh, Matt, I want to ask you something. Did you call Kevin boss? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, good.
I like that term. Matt, you call me boss. You can get your question on the air anytime you want.
I love it.
All right. Well, I appreciate it. You guys have a great day.
You too, Matt. Thanks a lot. I'm going to remember that. Let's see. We have.
You're going to remember that?
Yes, boss.
Thank you.
Anyway, we have a listener email who writes, recently you talked about sending a letter somewhere when one discontinues a credit card on their own volition, as to not have their credit ratings affected. We have two such credit cards and would like to send these letters, but I missed where you suggested. Would you please advise so you can send a letter if you are the one who wants to discontinue a credit card?
Sure. And the reason people typically choose to discontinue credit cards are many. They have a better option, or they're tired of paying annual fees. Or some people are self-actualized enough where they say, if this credit card is open, I will use it and I don't want to do that. Therefore, I'm closing it. But it's important, as it stands on your credit report. Sometimes if you just cancel it and say, I'm done, over or out, it shows up on your credit report that the company canceled the card. And that hurts your credit report more than if you cancel it. So you want to send a letter to the credit card company, and we'll put there's a template up on the web, a couple different of them actually, but we'll put them up at onyourmoney.com later on today again so people can find it. But you can just, you know, keep it in a Word document and cross out, you know, 1234 Main Street in Anytown, USA, and put your own information on there and send it to the credit card company. And then once you've sent it to them, call them back within a few weeks, verify that it's going on your credit report that you closed it, and then check your credit report at the places we mentioned before, specifically annualcreditreport.com. And it's not the end of the world if it looks like the company canceled it, but it's just better and easier if it reflects the accurate picture, which is that you credit it. So again, go to onyourmoney.com later on today, and we'll have that up for you.
And if you have a question for Kevin, you can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call us 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a certified financial planner, and he's with us every week at this time, or just about every week at this time. It is a live program on Tuesday mornings. It's rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings and again on Sunday mornings. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Debbie in Ashland is with us. Hello, Debbie. Hello, Debbie, are you there? I don't know. I know I have the right button pushed that time. Debbie might not be by the phone, but I know that she wanted to ask about having a little chunk of money available and wondering if she should pay off her credit card with that added cash, I guess, Kevin.
That can be a good idea, especially if the interest rate is over, you know, in the double digits, 12% or more. But typically, people are better served by channeling money into a pre-tax retirement plan, because the amount of money that they save in taxes by saving in a 401k or an IRA, if you don't have one at your disposal, or a 403b if you're a public employee, you save more in taxes than you do in interest. And so I generally believe in paying off the credit cards if you can, again, if it's over 12% or so. But otherwise, you're better off ramping up your pre-tax savings into your retirement plan and then just paying off the credit card with whatever you have left. And if you can help, try not to charge it up.
All right. Good luck to you, Debbie. Beth in Wausau is with us now. Hello, Beth.
Hi. Hey, Kevin, I have to say you're not the boss because I know your mom and she rocks.
I love it.
My birth mom? Yeah.
Anyway, my question, Kevin, for the last couple months, my husband and I have been going back and forth about we own our own home. We've owned it for 25 years this year, but I've been laid off for a year and a half and can only find part-time work. My husband's only working 30 hours a week. We're debating, should we try to sell our house and rent an apartment or should we just try to stick it out? We got about 6 years left on our mortgage.
I'm sorry. Did you say your husband is working?
Yeah, about 30 hours a week.
Okay. I definitely don't want
and
you
I'm
to...
Working,
you work periodically, okay. I say?
I'm working part-time, about 25 hours, not 20, 25 hours a week. So
okay.
We're struggling. We can do it, but do we enjoy life more if we, you know, we rent and we have more disposable income just to even, like, you know... Not do anything extravagant, but have some cash, or do we stick it out, you know? And
sure. What would you think you would sell your house for if you were to sell it?
95.
Okay. That's actually a good answer, and it's the answer that leads me to believe that you should just stay in the house. And the reason being is that, I don't know if you've looked around very much, but you're renting a similar house is probably, or even an apartment, is going to be pretty close to what you're paying right now for your mortgage. And yes, there's property taxes and other, you know, upkeep and all of that. But you've been smart enough to purchase a sensible home, a very modest price home, which I think is very wise in your situation. And so, yes, you can sell it and use some of the money. But what will happen is that, you know, you'll pay rent for the next, heaven knows how many years, and then that will use up all the proceeds that you've taken out of the house. Whereas, you know, the laws are the same then as they are now. Once you turn 62, you could actually get a reverse mortgage and pull the cash back out of the house, about two-thirds of the value, and still live in the house. And so all the things being equal, I would tell you to stay in the house unless you just say, no, we can't stand it. We want to be able to move from month to month or year to year and not have to worry about it. I think that the issues of renting aren't going to be they're going to be more than the consequences of having to make this mortgage payment and keep it. I'd tell you to stay in the house, all other things being equal.
Great. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks,
that's
Kevin.
That was what you wanted. Your husband wants to rent, doesn't he?
Actually, it's the other way around.
Oh.
I just had to be convinced, and I knew if you told me that would be it, then
oh.
I would believe it.
That's
good.
Because I'm a boss.
He's the boss, Beth. All right, thanks very much for the call. David in Woodstock, Illinois, is with us now. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and I appreciate that there's such places I can take advantage of some quick information like this. And to be quick, I have a car loan, paying it just fine. I mean, it's like a 14%, but I've been with my fiance here for 8 years. We're going to be getting married in a couple of months. Up until this point, we've had this car now for about a year and a half. We've been paying a very high car payment at about 14%, for the interest rate. And what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, my credit was never that great. Hers was good enough for us to get that car at that time. Now I'm starting to pay my bills down, but we went into a, you know, credit union the other day, or just to at least inquire to see if I might be able to refinance, and it looks like I won't be able to for, you know, just indefinitely right now until I get all my other bills in order and stuff. But what's the best way I can go about that, the fastest way to go about that to get my to get that refinance?
Sure. Well, good for you, David, for congratulations on getting married and for trying to get things in order and exploring all your opportunities. What's the value of the car, roughly?
The value is actually about $25,000, and I owe just less than that.
Okay, just less than that. So you're upside down a little bit on the car once you go back in on it. And the credit union said it's going to be a while until your situation is strong enough where you could refinance, correct?
Just a couple of months here, but I'll also have that added benefit of her and I being married and then, you know, working jointly together.
Sure. Have you given any thought to selling the car and exchanging to a more modest vehicle?
Well, of course, that was a consideration. I think, you know, I mean, after going in and seeing that I can't refinance it and paying, you know, such a high payment at this time, you know, $650, you know, $700 right in there, you know, it's either I stay with it now, and that's the fear. I'm just thinking, oh my gosh, this is that, you know, feeling of impending doom. I got to just keep doing this, and there's no other choice. You know, is it really just swap the car, or am I looking at a couple of years of, you know, doing that? I mean, knowing with my other credit issues and things like that.
Yeah, you can try another lender and see what they say, but my guess is even if you know if you're not in good enough shape to be able to refinance the vehicle, which is a secured loan, which should be easier to refinance than just a normal credit card, I would say that my first suggestion would be actually to sell it. And if you're making a $600 or $700 a month payment right now, you could drive an $8,400 car each year that you have this other car, and then throw it away at the end of the year and start over for what you're making in payments. And the way vehicles are right now, David, you can get a pretty nice car for $8,400, and it should last you a lot longer than just a year, and it will for sure be worth more than $8,400 or worth more than zero at the end of the year. So that's what I would suggest you do is and even go back to the same credit union and say, what if I were to sell this and we were to buy a cheaper vehicle? Could we still finance it here? If so, what would be the terms? And even if they say, well, it's still going to be 14%, your loan payment is going to be so much lower and so much more affordable that it's going to allow you to get back on your feet, pay off other debts, and remove one bigger stressor out of your life. And so if you can't do that, you're really going to have to buckle down and try to keep paying this thing off. But I agree with you. I think that it'll be a year probably until you can go back and refinance it at least. And even if you can, getting the payment interest rate down to 8% or so isn't going to be that big of a savings for you. And if you're upside down, even more so on the vehicle at the time, you might have to kick money in to get the refinancing anyway.
Good luck, David, and congratulations on your upcoming nuptials. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner and Managing Member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time now for Smart Assets. Last week we discussed how retirees can figure out how much of their liquid assets that they can spend each month. And this week, Kevin, what are we doing?
We are going to talk about the reasons that those people should err on the side of caution with their investments. And it goes back to what we discussed last week, our bury the money in the hole theory. When you're trying to figure out how much you can spend, add up all of your liquid assets, savings, IRAs, Roth IRAs, mutual funds, whatever you have, and then divide that by your life expectancy in months. And the net result is the amount that can be spent the next month. So let's say you're fortunate enough to have $300,000 in liquid savings, and you think you're going to last another 25 years. That's 300 months. And if you divide $300,000 by 300 months, you get about $1,000 per month. And that figure shows why these people should be more conservative with their money.
How so?
Well, if that number already exceeds their current desired spending, especially once they add it to Social Security or pension payments or any other extra earnings, why do they need to take a lot more risk on right now, especially when stock prices are near all-time highs, bond prices are near all-time lows, interest rates are near all-time low, rather? Being aggressive at this point in their lives is kind of like driving down the street near your home 70 miles an hour as you try to get into the driveway. There's very little reward or need to drive that fast when you're so close to home, but there's a very big risk that you could, you know, get in an accident or hit a kid.
Well, now you tell me. Well, what if the number allowed is less than what the retirees need.
So they're saying, okay, they need to maybe make a bigger rate of return, right? Because they need to catch up. Actually, they can't afford those bigger losses because if they do lose a bunch of that money, they have to cut their spending down even more. They're better off looking to cut back on spending or maybe tapping home equity to cover bigger expenses as well, pick up some part-time earnings if they can, and still erring on the side of caution with their money.
But what about the higher long-term returns? Can't that eventually make up for bigger losses?
It's not as much as one might think, and it gives us an opportunity to trot out our on-your-money investment scenario. Let's say you have two options, and it's over a five-year period. And option A pays you 3% every single year, year in, year out. And option B gives you 10% per year in 4 out of the 5 years. So when you'll get 10%, 10%. And 10%, 10%, but then in one of the 5 years you will lose 20%, but the other four you'll make 10%. Which one would you choose, Joy?
I would probably choose B.
Obviously, and many people would say, hey, I can live with a 20% drop because I want those big 10% gains in the majority of the other years. But in option A, you obviously have a 3% average annual rate of return. Option B only works out to 3.2%
really?
Average annual rate of return, and that's only if you don't panic after the 20% drop and yank the money out and move it into something more conservative. And most retirees have a hard enough time with this drop at that time and moving it, or keeping it in something that's supposedly going to grow. And if you're pulling money out of the portfolio and trying to live off of it, in a downtime, it exacerbates the decline because you're pulling, if you pull, let's say, $3,000 a month out of your assets, as the value shrinks, you're pulling a bigger percentage out at the least opportune time.
I did not know that. That's pretty amazing. Well, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And Paulette in Grays Lake, Illinois is with us now. Hi, Paulette.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Joy. This has something to do with something you just mentioned about a home equity line of credit. My husband and I have a HELOC from our credit union, and it's at the prime rate, and it's going to expire in July 2014. And my husband is reluctant to use the HELOC on major home repairs that we need. He does not want to pay interest. I just signed up to get my Social Security at age 62, and this will be my only income. I lost my job years ago, and I have my 403B. My husband's still working. We need major repairs on the house. We need a new roof. We need new flooring. And he believes that it's... you know, that we'd be wasting money by paying interest on this home equity loan. And I said, my view on this is that I don't think it's wise to pull money out of our 401ks to pay for this these kinds of major home repairs.
I've got money on Paulette.
Yes, in part because she's the one calling in. We always side with whomever is bright enough to call in and state their case. So it's an interesting court of law. If the other party doesn't show up, we just default to whoever's here. So, but actually, Paulette, reality and common sense is on your side. First of all, a couple things about interest. Interest is not your biggest problem right now, and especially at a time when rates are extremely low. And because you actually do have the savings that your husband has, I bet if you were to pull the 401k money out, you will pay more in taxes by pulling it out of there, even in a lower income environment, than you will pay in interest for several years. And you can always pull that money out in the future to pay the home equity line of credit off if the rate rises too fast or it's just bugging you to have the loan out there, bugging your husband. But in the meantime, first of all, this doesn't sound like, you know, oh gosh, we've always wanted a sunroom. This sounds like, you know, almost structural repairs and getting the house back up to acceptable levels, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
I mean,
so this is something you have to do.
The flooring that we need is everything is original to the house when it was built in 1991, so
okay.
It's necessary.
So it's necessary, and although the money technically goes as a debt on your balance sheet, you have increased the value of your home. Maybe not even by 100% of what you borrow to pay for this, but for sure by, 60 or 70% or something like that. Plus, you get to enjoy it. Whereas if you say, well, we're just going to build up all of our savings until we have enough to make this repair, that could take 5 or 10 years to get enough to do it, and especially in your situation when you're on a fixed income. So, no, I definitely would tell you to tap the home equity line of credit, and even if you say, well, how are you going to pay it off, slowly drain the money out of your 401k so that you stay in a lower tax bracket. And I've done these calculations 100 times for people, and I can almost guarantee that what you pay in interest will be less than what you would pay in taxes if you were to just pull a big lump sum out of the 401k.
All right. Thank you very much, Paulette, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I learned almost everything that I know without ever gaining knowledge.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and millions of students are heading to college these days, and Kevin, we are going to we're going to help them out.
Yes, we are. About 22 million are heading back to some form of post-secondary higher education this fall, according to Pew Research. And we thought we'd put together a financial to-do list that parents and students can share, and maybe even have some stress-free conversations. And we'll have 5 areas in which they should address.
All right, let's go to step number one.
Might as well have the kid develop some good habits by tracking her spending every single day, and then monitor it every single month and note what is rising and falling over the previous month and compare. And it's not only a good idea because it helps figure out what the kid actually needs to support herself in college, but she can isolate some things and say, gee, I spent, $100 on pizza last month. Maybe I should dial that back a little bit. And that's also the reason that I have to go out and buy a new wardrobe as well.
So, all right, what if the student won't track expenses on his or her own?
If she or he has an iPhone or an Android that she absolutely must have, you can download a program like Mint or Dollarbird or some others out there that allow her to add in her expenses. Or the parents should have access to the kids' savings or checking account. And it's a good idea anyway just to make sure that they're not doing something stupid that's going to incur some fees or running low, but also can see where the expenses are going and maybe even get a report that shows each place or each ATM withdrawal, whatever. And if the kid balks at it, you can make it a condition of their support and say, look, while we're responsible for your finances, we have to know where the money's going. Therefore, you have to give us access to the account.
Well, I can just hear students today, this is an invasion of privacy.
Attica. Attica, right. That's when you invoke the trust but verify rule, that no, I trust you, I want to help you do this, but much in the way that when we taught you to ride a bike, we put training wheels on the side and we ran along close to you, so if you tipped over, we could try to catch you. And in fact, I would take that philosophy even one step further and consider freezing the kid's credit report. There's a law out there right now that says kid under 21 cannot open up a credit card without the parents' consent unless they have income, and that income is up really to the discretion of the credit card issuer, and so sometimes the kids can get by and sneak in and get one on their own. So go to tinyurl.com/cfreeze, tinyurl.com/cfreeze to find out how to freeze not only your but your kid's credit report. And again, we'll put that up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
Well, what if the student really needs a credit
card? I need a credit card for emergencies. If you really go along with it, rather than giving the kid his or her own card, you may want to add the child to a specific card that the parent already has and set down some boundaries and guidelines for when the kid can and can't use the card. And that has 2 advantages. One is that the parent actually gets control over the card, can cut the kid off at any time, but the kid still has access to it if there is indeed an accepted emergency. And because the kid's name on it and the kid is on the card and embossed right on it, it can help build the kid's credit report for future use.
I think I counted four. What's number five?
Call your insurance agent. First of all, in your car insurance, if you have a teenager out of the house who's not driving, that will probably result in a lower premium for you. But if the kid is driving and still on your policy, you should let them know of that the car and the kid are off at college, and if that changes your premiums at all. You might want to consider renter's insurance for the kid if he or she has some high-end electronics, computers, whatever. If they're in the dorm, you probably don't need it. The homeowner's policy should cover things in the dorm, but actual renter's insurance if they're living in an apartment. Some liability insurance is nice anyway, but especially if you say, look, my kid does something really stupid off at college and I get sued for it and I lose the lawsuit, do I have coverage in place to cover any of those damages? And finally, health insurance. Make sure that the kid is still on your health insurance and has access to it and access to care in his or her area. And you might want to have HIPAA documents signed so that if something does happen to the kid, you have immediate access to his or her condition already pre-established rather than have to scramble around at one of the scariest time in a parent's life.
All right, and there you have it. You have the five tips for parents and college students. Maybe you have a question about your kid going back to school, your adult child who is attending college, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Molly in Rice Lake is our next caller. Hello, Molly.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question?
I am calling because I'm 26. I just got married, and my husband and I are looking at getting a house. He has never had any credit card, any loan other than student loans, and I've never had any loans at all. But I do have four credit cards that I don't keep a balance on, and their interest rate is between like 19% and 24%, which I think is really high. So my question twofold, I'm just worried that we have a really limited credit history, so I'm worried how that's going to affect taking out a loan. And then also just what I can do about those high interest rates on my credit card.
Sure. You might want to do a few things. Have you checked your credit score yet?
Yes. Last spring I did.
Okay. Can you reveal the number? I guess not.
No, I guess not. She got upset. No, she actually, her cell phone dropped off. So let's
well,
say
good.
Was,
I hope she's safe.
Let's say it was okay, but not great. It sounded like she doesn't have a lot of credit history and wondered if she should do stuff to build it up.
Sure. One thing she can do is contact those credit card providers and say, hey, I think I have a pretty decent credit score, and I deserve a lower interest rate than what you're charging me, and I'll shop it around if you don't give me a lower one. And if they don't, she should shop around, because that's pretty high for people who don't carry balances. Even if she can't find a lower interest rate, and she wants to build up her credit score, she can just use the credit card and then make sure to just pay it off each month. And doing so will rapidly build up her credit score to the mid-700s level where you need it to get the best term. Actually, over 800 is the best, but mid-700s gives you just about every bounty out there from lenders that you could possibly get. And don't be afraid to ask any credit card provider. If you have some leverage and you have a decent score, to say, I'm going to take this elsewhere, because they have a lot of different options at their disposal, and the cost of acquiring a customer is very high versus the cost of lowering the interest rate. So don't be afraid to negotiate the terms with them and see what you can come up with.
All right, Molly, if you're still listening, congratulations. Sounds like you're off to a happy start. Let's go to Gordy and Eagle next. Hello, Gordy.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for the show. I was just calling. I know your guest has mentioned reverse mortgage as an option several times, but my father had passed away in California, and he was 87 when he took out this reverse mortgage, which was a pretty bad idea. And the family found out that you have 6 months to sell this house or foreclosure starts. So he really... You know, he paid $12,000 in closing costs, and this was from, you know, a pretty reputable mortgage company, and we couldn't sell it within that 6 months. We couldn't rent it out. We couldn't live in it. And the other problem is if we pay off the balance, it's still not titled to us. And a lot of times, at least in California, I'm not sure what it is here in Wisconsin, it took 18 months to get into court to settle the estate. That was just the waiting period. So, you know, this reverse mortgage really isn't quite the ticket that Kevin keeps on mentioning. There's so many pitfalls to that it's just not written into the person who's taking out the loan's favor.
Gordy, thanks for the call. So if someone dies and they have a reverse mortgage...
Reverse mortgages are not good for the people left behind. They are for the benefit of the person who needs money desperately and wants to remain in their home. But it's not meant as a way to pass an asset on to... They have the option of doing it, but it's very difficult, as Gordy says, to do it, and especially if you're trying to do it after the person has actually passed away. I do not recommend using a reverse mortgage if you have a property that you would like to pass on to your children, because between the fees and the rising balance of it, they charge interest on it. It's very difficult, as Gordy mentioned, to get the house back to the family after you pass away. But for someone who says, I have no money, and I need money on which to live, and I don't want to move out of my house, there's really no other way to do it other than selling the house and then using the proceeds either to buy a smaller house or to rent an apartment. And the longer the person lives, the more likely it is that the proceeds from the home will be eaten up by the living expenses and the apartment rent. At least with a reverse mortgage, they're able to stay in the home and use money not just to survive, but hopefully provide for a better life or health care expenses or whatever they might need. I'm not a 100% fan of them, but I think people who are in a corner like that should look at all their options, and a reverse mortgage is one of them.
Thanks very much, Gordy. Bruce in Madison wants to know that he says he and his wife are 54. He wants to know the pros and cons of long-term health care insurance.
Yeah, long-term care insurance is a good idea if it makes you feel good to have it. But the problem is that you don't know if you will need it. You don't know when you will need it. You don't know what kind of care you might need. And you don't know if the policy will pay for that particular kind of care. And quite frankly, it's becoming more and more apparent that many of the companies who are providing these policies may not be able to afford to pay that care when you might need it. So look on it as a 30-day proposition, meaning once you qualify for it, make your monthly premium, and then every 30 days, if you want it and need it and can pay for it, make the next 30-day premium for it. But when people are in their mid-50s and they're being sold this and saying, oh, buy it now so when you're 85, it'll be there for you, I can't make that statement that they'll need it ever and that the company will be there to provide whatever kind of care they need. But if it feels good to have it and you can afford it, get it. And we will be talking a lot more about this over the next few weeks.
Well, that's good. But you did, I know, in past programs say that certain income guidelines you might consider this.
Yeah, it relates to assets. And if you have between $200,000 and $2 million in assets, you can look for the policy. Less than that, you probably can't afford the premiums. And anything more than that, you can probably self-insure, meaning pay for whatever care you might need out of your own assets.
Good enough. So what's the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, we had an email from Jeff. And Jeff said, I've been a long-time listener to On Your Money, and all of your recommendations on purchasing a new car, you have omitted a reference to carbargains.com. I came across this resource 8 years ago, and I've recommended it to everyone I meet. And if you go to carbargains.com, you'll be redirected to this site where you pay $200. The car buyer visits car lots, test drive the autos, and then they get a report on the vehicle plus bids from other dealers. We talked about other services like this, but this one looks pretty neat, too. Carbargains.com, and we'll put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And I understand that you are going to actually not labor the day.
I'll be laboring, but it won't be on preparing for the show, so I'm taking I consider it a well-deserved vacation.
I do, too. And Kevin is off next week. He will be back on the following week to answer more of your questions on your money. Kevin, time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is here just about every week at this time for On Your Money.